My name is Cal Harper, and this is the second most important day of my life. Remove him, the manager of the French bistro calls out behind us. Sorry, Cal, my client Alberto apologizes, his body shaking as I help him hobble back toward our van. From the stench on his breath, Alberto's been drinking hard. From his fresh split lip, plus the tear in his ratty t-shirt, he's been fighting too. Welcome to Fort Lauderdale Beach. Just another day in paradise.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, best-selling author Brad Meltzer reads from the Book of Lies. His seventh thriller links over hundreds of centuries two tales of familial tragedy. Set in contemporary Florida, the plot revolves around the discovery of the ancient weapon with which Cain killed Abel. And there are echoes of another crime, the real-life 1932 slaying of a man named Mitchell Siegel. His grieving son would, within months, create a comic book, Superman. Brad Meltzer grew up in Florida and New York. He trained as a lawyer and lived for a while in Washington, D.C. He returned in September 2008 for this reading at D.C.'s Politics and Prose bookstore.
So this is obviously a fun signing for me. It's good because I see people I know. I see people who remember when I had hair. And that got such an easy laugh. And the truth is, this is an important and emotional signing because it is obviously a homecoming. And I do want to talk about one thing, because one thing has happened since the last one and this one. And there's too many friends here not to acknowledge this giant elephant in my personal life. But I lost my mom a couple months ago. And people who know me know what that meant. And my mom is the kind of person, you know, when we hit the number one spot on the bestseller list, I called my mother. And, you know, you got to call your mom. And I call my mom and I tell her, and she's sobbing and sobbing. And I say, you know, when you hear your mom cry, you start crying. And I say to my mom, because I'm worried she's going to crash the car or something. And I say, where are you? And she says to me, I'm at Marshall's. And of course she's at Marshall's, right? Because, like, you know, we hit the top of the bestseller list and she's still trying to find a deal on irregular socks. But it was my mother's greatest lesson to me, and that is the lesson to never, ever, 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 ever change for anyone. And some friends know that story, but what I want to tell you is the recent follow-up, because it is like the epilogue to the tale, is that my mom, when she passed, Marshall, she was such a good customer, I'm not even making this up, that Marshall's heard about her love for their store and sent me a gift card in honor of my mother to pass along to a breast cancer place. And my sister said, I don't know if mom would be happy right now or really pissed she can't spend it. But that was the coolest thing I ever saw from Marshall. So this book is a book I started writing as she got sick, and it is a book that I finished as she passed. And there's no coincidence, not only that it's dedicated to her, but there's no coincidence that the main character in the book is dealing with the loss of his mother. And it is an emotional book for me. It is a personal book for me. And her sickness is, I think, the only thing that made me be as honest intellectually with the reader as I've ever been, because most of the time I'm not. I'm just trying to entertain you. And this one is, I think, infused with her, and so tonight is for her. So let's start with that. To tell you a little bit about this book, The Book of Lies started in a room like this with far more Jews because it was in Florida. And this, oh, I'm telling you, this is also true. You can't make this up. I'm at a signing, and a woman, I don't even ask for questions, and a woman stands up and yells this at me because she knows my love of Superman. It's not even a question, and she just says, I know more about Superman than you'll ever know. Only in Florida, like, crazy Jewish ladies stand up and yell this at you. And I think to myself, lady, there's no way you know more about Superman than I know. And she says, sure I do. She says, because Jerry Siegel, who created Superman, is my uncle. And you'd think I'd take that as a hint and be like, oh, that's pretty cool. But I don't really think that much of it until, I'm not joking, a minute later, another old guy stands up and goes, I was in the army with Jerry Siegel. And then it's like every Jew that ever was near Jerry Siegel is like in the physical room where I am. So finally I'm like, I got to pay attention to this. So I take down her number. I take the other guy's number. And I'm like, I got to check this out. You know, I mean, I'm on a book tour for the Book of Fate. If you don't listen to the fate at that moment, you're an idiot. And so I call her, and she's the one who explains to me this theory that I'd heard rumblings about, but this theory of this unsolved murder of Mitchell Siegel. And it was an amazing theory because when they ask in 50 years of interviews, nobody knows the story because in these 50 years of interviews, when they ask Jerry Siegel and say, where'd you get the idea for Superman? This guy never once says, my dad died in a crime. His dad dies in a crime, and a couple weeks later, he creates the world's greatest crime fighter and then tells nobody. And that's an amazing story to me. So I become obsessed with this story. That's why the world got Superman, not because America's the greatest country on earth. It's because a little boy lost his father. So I become obsessed, and I think I'm going to solve this thing myself because, you know, I'm that good at this. And I go back, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, maybe I'm playing a little bit of nerd Freud here. You know, maybe I'm just making up the connections that aren't there. So I fly to Cleveland. And I go and I look through the old microfiche, you know, that are in Cleveland, and I made just a hand signal like this, even though it's microfiche. But I'm looking through these old microfiche, and I said, let's see what Jerry Siegel's reading the day after his dad dies. Let's just see what he's, you know, you don't know what the influence is. I want to check it out. And as I look through, this is the day after his father is killed. He looks, and I'm looking through, and there is a letter to the editor that's sent there, and it's about why vigilantes should not exist in society. And the letter is signed by A.L. Luther, Lex Luthor. And I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. Is this where we get Lex Luthor from? It's spelled E-R instead of O-R. But I'm like, is this where it's from? And no one's ever found this because no one's as big a loser as me and cares. But I found it, and I loved it. And I just started finding these details. And you'll see them. I don't want to ruin the book, but you'll see them. And they're real. I didn't make it up. Obviously, there are things I did make up, and hopefully those will be apparent as well. And for those I fool you on, the end of the book does actually have an author's note to tell you. And at the same time, that gave me half the story because I had this Superman story, but even for me, it was too geeky even for me, and that's saying something. And what happened, I went back to something that happened 11 years ago. And 11 years ago, when 10th Justice came out, my editor called me in and said, okay, what's your next book going to be? And this is a terrifying moment, right? Because it's the moment where you have to – what's your follow-up? What are you going to do next? What's your next trick? And I said to him, I want to write a story about Cain and Abel. And my editor looks at me at the time and wisely says to me, you're an idiot. And he says to me, you know, we just got you on the bestseller list. You're an unknown guy. We somehow got you on there. We're marketing you as the next John Grisham. Why are you going to go do that? And I had this moment where I could either be strong and bold and stand up for what I believed in, or I could cave. And I caved faster than anyone in the history of caving because, I mean, I just barely paid off my student loans. I wasn't going to risk it, you know, no way. And so I wrote the book that they wanted me to write, and I stayed in the genre they wanted me to stay in. And make no mistake, this is still a thriller. But I remembered that story. I remembered that story of Cain and Abel, which was sitting in my head marinating for 11 years. And a friend of mine said to me, you know the story of Eve and the apple in the Garden of Eden? And I said, yeah. And he says, because the word apple never appears in the Bible. And he said, the original translation is that it's a fig or a fruit, some say a pomegranate. And the word apple was put there by the Greeks when they translated it in Greece because apples were a sign of destruction. And they added the word apple. That's how we got it there. And then he said, how did Cain kill Abel? What's the murder weapon? And I said, I don't know, a rock, a stone. He says, right, some people say it's a rock or stone. Where do you see that in the Bible? Because the Cain and Abel story is 16 lines of the Bible. It doesn't say anything about rocks or stones. It says Abel, you know, Cain slew his brother Abel. And then he says, so some people say it's a rock or a stone. Shakespeare said that it was the jawbone of an animal. Rembrandt agreed and put it in his painting. And then some people say that Cain bit Abel's throat, and that's where we get vampires from. And this was just cool to me. I love this stuff. I mean, I just was like, that's cool. And then I started doing more research, and I found out that, you know, the best stories are actually – they're not on the internet. They're not digitized yet. The best writing that's been done about it intellectually, all these great old journal articles that I could find were in – I mean, I had to go – it's hard to imagine, gasp, a real library. But I went to the Library of Congress, and the people at the Library of Congress were kind enough to put up with my insanity and kept giving me all these articles and sent me one that had the greatest theory that I saw, which was – when you look at the story of Cain and Abel, look in a modern Bible today, and it says that Cain shouts to God and says, you know, my punishment is too great to bear. And it's, you know, that's why we hate Cain, because he kills his brother and then says to God, what did I do wrong? Why are you going to punish me? It's, you know, that's too much. You killed your brother. And you can just as easily look at the old Geniza fragments that they found centuries ago in Egypt and look at that same section, and it could just as easily be translated as, my sin is too great to forgive. And now that's Cain saying to God, listen, what I did is horrible. I'm so sorry. Don't forgive me. And that's a very different version of Cain than the one we know. And it's the idea that Cain maybe, just maybe, may not be the bad guy in the story, that what the story is about is not vengeance, but maybe forgiveness and God's capacity for it. And not to get completely ridiculously intellectual and make this sound like a graduate English program class, but and also not to compare biblical characters and comic book characters, but these are the great stories of our time. And the reason why Cain and Abel persist and the reason why Superman persists all these years is not because they're just interesting and not because they're just, you know, cool and because brothers die and Lois Lane gets saved, but it's because they say something about us. These stories always say something about us. Cain and Abel says something about us. Superman says something about us. And that's what I love about these stories. So you will see that this is a story that is about stories and how we perceive them and how we tell them and how we change them to fit whatever we need when we need them. And with that said, I will read from a short section from the Book of Lies. And just to set this up, I'm going to read from chapter 2. So I'm going to totally ruin. Spoiler alert, comic readers. All you need to know at this point is that Cal, who's the main character of the book, his father basically kills his mother, and he watches it. It's an accident, and his father goes away to prison. So kills his mother, very uplifting tale, totally appropriate for all the small children in the back. This is chapter 2 of the Book of Lies. My name is Cal Harper, and this is the second most important day of my life. Remove him, the manager of the fresh French bistro calls out behind us. Sorry, Cal, my client Alberto apologizes, his body shaking as I help him hobble back toward our van. From the stench on his breath, Alberto's been drinking hard. From his fresh split lip, plus the tear in his ratty t-shirt, he's been fighting too. Welcome to Fort Lauderdale Beach. Just another day in paradise. You planning on helping here? I call out to Roosevelt, who's reclining in the passenger seat of our dumpy white van. I'm mentoring, Roosevelt calls back in a thick Tennessee drawl. No, you're sitting on your rear while I do all the work, I tell him. What do you think mentoring is, he asks, lumbering out like an old mountain cat. You got him, I ask as I hand him Alberto. Isn't that why God put me on this planet, he says, his dyed black aging hippie ponytail flapping in the salty ocean breeze. At 42, Roosevelt's old enough to know better than the ponytail, but we all have our weaknesses. Man, Alberto, you reek. To the few passing tourists still walking the beach, we probably look like mobsters, but our job's far more dangerous than that. Listen, thanks for calling us instead of the cops, I tell the restaurant manager, a middle-aged guy who looks like a ferret. I'm no schmuck, he laughs, dropping his French accent. Cops would take 2 hours. You take out the trash fast. He offers a handshake, and as I reach to take it, I spot a $100 bill in his palm. I pull back as if he's offering a coiled snake. Just our way of saying thanks, he says. I don't shake back. Do you understand what I do, I ask, my thick Adam's apple pumping with each syllable. Ah, geez, you're going to give me some self-important speech now, aren't you? No speech, I tell him. We take out the homeless and we bring them the shelters. And what, if you accept a tip, it'll make it a less of a good deed? I respect that, I do, he says. But come on, be fair to yourself. As he motions to my faded black t-shirt, he says, what are you, 30 years old with that baby face? You're wearing secondhand sneakers and sweatpants to work. When was the last time you got a haircut? And come on, look at your van. I glance back at the van's peeling tinted windows and the swarm of rust along the back. Take the money, kid. If you don't use it for yourself, at least help your organization. I shake my head. You called my client trash. To my surprise, he doesn't get defensive or mad. You're right. I'm sorry, he says, still holding out the money. Let this be my apology, please. Don't make it the end of the world. I stare at my sweatpants, calculating all of the underwear and socks I could buy for our clients. Come on, bro, he says. Even Bob Dylan did an iPod commercial. What the fudge, Cal? You didn't take the money, did you, Roosevelt asks as I climb back into our van. Why are you so stubborn? Same reason you say dumb crap like what the fudge. That's different. It's not different, I shoot back. You were a minister, so you don't like to curse. I get it. But it's a choice that you make on principle. You were a minister, Alberto asked from the back seat. I thought you were some special agent who got arrested and fired. Twisting the ignition and hitting the gas, I don't say a word. That was Cal, Roosevelt points out as we take off down A1A. Ask him why he got fired. Ask Cal, Roosevelt adds. Losing his badge, you know, that's what turned his hair white, he says, as he points to my full head of thick silver hair. Nuh-uh, Alberto says. You didn't get that from your mom or daddy? I click my front teeth together, staring out at the closed tourist tea shops that line the beach. The only thing I got from my parents was a light blue government form with the charges against my father. My dad got 8 years at Glades Correction Institution. The state of Florida gave me 6 minutes to say goodbye. I remember the room smelled like spearmint gum and hairspray. Life is filled with trap doors. I happened to swan dive through mine when I was 9 years old. That was the last time I saw my dad. Gah, Roosevelt shouts, his ruddy features burning bright. You should have taken that restaurant money. Roosevelt, the only reason that he was offering that cash was so when he goes home tonight, he doesn't feel nearly as guilty for sweeping away the homeless guy that he thought was bad for his fake French bistro business. So go pray or send an email to heaven or do whatever you do to let your God weigh in. But I'm telling you, we're here to help those who need it, not to give fudging penance. His lips purse at my use of the G word. Roosevelt will joke about anything. His long hair. His obsession with early chubby Janet Jackson, so much better than the later thinner model. Even his love of your mama's so fat jokes as a tool for changing the subject during an awkward social situation. But he'll never joke about God. Cal, you know what your problem is, he says? You're a damn walrus. When it's walking on land, walruses are the most lumbering, awkward creatures that God ever gave us. But the moment it enters the water, that sucker is quicksilver. Foom, he says, slicing his hand through the air like a ski jump. Same with you, Cal. When you're working with clients, you're in the water. Foom, just quicksilver. The problem is all you want to do is stay underwater. And even if walrus knows it, if you don't come up for air, you're going to die. That's a very inspiring and far too visual analogy, I tell him. But I know who I am and I like who I am, and when it comes to ass-faced restaurant managers who treat money as some green-colored rosary, well, no offense, but I'm not for sale, and you of all people shouldn't be either. Roosevelt leans back in his reclined seat and lets out a hearty laugh. Your mama's so fat, Roosevelt. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. The horse on her polo shirt is real. You used that last week. Your mama's so fat in elevators it says maximum occupancy 12 patrons or your mama. Does that really make you happier, I ask him. Just take the money next time, Cal, Roosevelt says as he twists the dial on an old stolen police scanner that we have superglued to our dash. We have an 86 requesting nearby units to Victoria Park, a woman's voice says through the scanner. The park is less than a mile away. Turns out this is the call I've been waiting 19 years for. Cal, I need help, Roosevelt screams. What the hell's going on, I call back, sticking my head out the window and squinting into the darkness. He's kneeling over our newest homeless client, who's curled at the base of a queen palm tree. It's a bad one, Cal. He's a bleeder. A ping of rain hits the windshield, and I jump at the impact. If this were my first day on the job, I'd leap out of the van and rush like a panicked child to Roosevelt's side. But this isn't day one. It's year two. You got a social, I call out. Kneeling at the base of the queen palm, Roosevelt tucks his flashlight under his armpit and rolls what looks like a heavy-set man onto his back. As the light shines down, even from here, I can see the blood that soaks the man's stomach. His wallet's gone, Roosevelt shouts. Sir, sir, can you hear me? I need your social security number. In my left hand, I'm already dialing 911. In my right, I prop my laptop on the center console. But I never take my eyes off Roosevelt. Breast cancer took my aunt, the aunt who raised me. I don't have many friends. I have this job, and I have Roosevelt. Cal, I got a social, Roosevelt shouts. Sir, were you mugged? You have a gunshot wound. Give me 1 sec, I call back. The computer hums, our tracking software loads, and I click on the button marked Find Client. On screen, a blank form opens, and I tab over to the section labeled Social Security. Cal, I need you to hurry, Roosevelt adds as the man whispers something. Go ahead, ready, I insist, all set to type with one hand. In my other, I grip my cell and hit send as 911 continues to start ringing. Years ago, if you wanted to drive around and work with the homeless, all you needed was a van and some Lysol. Today, you just need their social security number. 07805-1120, Roosevelt announces I key in the man's social security number. In my ear, the 911 line continues to ring. In the distance, refusing to wait, Roosevelt rips open the man's shirt and starts applying pressure to the wound. And on screen, I get my first good look at his identity. Lloyd Randall Harper. Dania Beach, Florida. Date of birth, June 19th, 52 years old. A swell of heat burns my chest and my throat. I can't breathe. I open my mouth to call Roosevelt's name, but my lips won't move. Lloyd Randall Harper. My father. This is 911, the operator announces in my ear. What's your emergency? There's the end of chapter 3. there are two things I do want to talk about and then open it to questions. Two things that are important with this book. The first is if you look at the inside jacket flap, you will see that we have a soundtrack for The Book of Lies. And does a novel need a soundtrack? No, it absolutely does not. Is it cool to have a soundtrack? Yes, it is absolutely cool to me. And it is cool because Sony Music let me build a soundtrack. And it was great because it let me, you know, be geeky in a totally different way when they heard my musical taste and I demanded to have the Greatest American Hero theme on the soundtrack. And they said to me, we don't own that, and Warner Brothers owns that, and you can't have that. And I said, oh, okay. And I knew that Stephen J. Cannell, who's a fellow novelist who created The Greatest American Hero and The A-Team and, let's be honest, my childhood, I called him up, and I got his number from someone who knew him, and I said, listen, they told me that Warner Brothers owns this, and I really would like to get it. And he says, oh, Warner Brothers doesn't own that. And I said, oh really, who does? And he says, I do. And I said, can we have it? And he was like, yeah. And I was so happy that we got the Greatest American Hero theme. I was even happier that we got R.E.M. And I was probably happiest when I heard this song called The Book of Lies, because someone wrote a song called The Book of Lies. And I don't care if it's the crappiest song in the world. It's got my title in it. That's the best song I ever heard in my life. So you can listen to it. And the thing that I actually do think is cool is that we actually scored the book. So it has a soundtrack that is not just pop songs, but you can hear the score. They gave a guy at Sony the book. We gave it to him early. We picked out the key chapters of the book, and then he picked out the instrumental music that should go with it. He sent me the list. I thought about half of it was completely wrong, half of it was completely right, and I sent back the part that I hated. We came to the conclusion, and if what you can do is you can literally put on that chapter I just read, which I've now, you know, totally told you is the best chapter in the book, because I just said it's with the best chapters. How gratuitous am I? You can put on the chapter and you can play the song as best I can explain it that is playing in my head, that emotionally resonates to me as I listen and read my own stuff. So I think that's a pretty cool thing, and I hadn't seen it done before, and to me that's the best kind of thing to do, is what's never been done before. The other thing I do want to talk about is the Superman house, because when I researched this book, obviously, it's about the murder weapon that Cain used to kill Abel. It's about the murder weapon that was used to kill Jerry Siegel's father and led to the creation of Superman. But to research the book, I said, I got to go back to Cleveland. I got to see the moment of creation. I got to see where Superman was created, where this young kid, 17 years old, imagine for a moment, sits up in bed one night and says, I have an idea. And I figured it's going to be like a Norman Rockwell picture right there. They're going to have apple pie on the front porch waiting for me. And the house where Google was founded is protected, and the garage where Hewlett-Packard was founded is preserved. But the house where Superman was created is a mess. And I don't mean a mess where it needs a little bit of paint. It's wrecked. There are giant holes in the wall. People live there, and there's giant holes in the ceiling. And you can see where the plaster is ripped away, and you can see all the exposed wood slats underneath. It is just unreal. And I looked at that, and I thought, that is absolutely wrong. It is wrong, because Superman is our modern-day mythology, and I believe ordinary people change the world. I don't care where you went to school. I don't care how you look. I don't care how much money you make. That's all nonsense. I believe in regular people. I believe in Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who was so poor, these two kids, that they used to draw on the back of wallpaper, and they came up with the greatest idea for a hero that no one ever heard of. I love that story. I believe in that story. I believe in the greatness in everybody, and I think that the best part of the Superman story is not Superman. The best part is Clark Kent. And you want to know why? Because we're all Clark Kent. We all know what it's like to be boring and ordinary and wish we could rip open our shirt at a moment and help somebody and do something good. And we all have our moments. And that's why every hero after Superman, when they gave him superpowers and they gave him a costume, never worked the same, because they didn't have Clark Kent. And so I started calling people in the comic book industry, and I said, you got to see these pictures. You got to hear what the house is like. And some friends who draw comics started drawing. And writers started donating things. Stephen Colbert heard about it and made a donation. The TV show Heroes, you can go and get a walk-on role if you're the high bidder and be on the TV show Heroes in a walk-on part. And then we announced it to the world on Tuesday. We launched a site called OrdinaryPeopleChangeTheWorld.com. And it is about nothing but that belief. And we have the auction going. We just got a call from Letterman who says he wants to do something. We got a call today from Glenn Beck who says he wants to do something. And maybe it's just the bandwagon, and maybe it's just cool, but I think people believe in Superman. And I know he seems like a character that's a big, giant, dumb Boy Scout, but Superman is never the story about the guy who gets Lois Lane or the guy who beats Lex Luthor. The story of Superman is about the greatness within all of us. and being just a regular person and trying to do something that is beyond you. And that is why I think the dream persists. So obviously, I'd love you to go bid and do whatever. You can also buy t-shirts or make a donation, but that's my little, I got the little pulpit, and so it's bully. With that said, I'd love to take questions, and you can ask me anything. I write fiction, I'll make something up, and let's see where we go. Yeah, the question is, favorite piece of research for this one? Obviously, the Superman stuff is near and dear to me. I love it. I can't get enough of it. And the more I started digging, the more I you know, you find things. Listen, whatever you want to see, when you want to see that mirror, the mirror becomes that, and you get to see yourself. But in the story, I found myself. I did. I found my voice in a strange way that I hadn't before. It's still a thriller, but I just found something that was, I don't know, more honest. And when I wrote my first novel, your book comes out, and then you get reviews, and that's it. And then the second novel comes out, and you get reviews, and that's it. And when the third novel was published, I got an email from a woman, stranger, I don't know. She came through the website, and she emailed me and said, Brad, I've read 3 of your books now. What are your issues with your father? And none of the books that I'd written were about my father. They all had about one page that were where the character interacts with his father. But, man, I was clearly putting stuff in this book that I didn't even realize I was putting in there. And anyone who knows my father knows he's insane. See, everyone laughing is like, he is, yeah. But my dad's, he's great, but anyone who has a big father in their life knows that they cast big shadows. And this was what I had to work on. So every time I would find something about Mitchell Siegel or Jerry Siegel, I think the greatest part of the research was when I got to speak to Jerry Siegel's wife. She's the model for Lois Lane. And I've spoken to presidents, and I've spoken to senators, and I've done all the research and gone to all these, fun things. But I'm talking to Lois Lane, right? I mean, that sends a geek meter. It's like, pins it to the wall right here, It's like, oh, it was incredible to me. I mean, she was the one that they drew when they drew her. And I got to say to her, tell me what Jerry Siegel told you about his father. Did he talk about it? No. You tell me 50 years you're together and you never, ever say anything about your dad to your wife. I mean, it's an incredible story there. There's got to be a story there. As far as a detail, one of my favorite things in the whole book, and you'll see it at the end, people have already asked me if it's real. I was doing research with this guy who was taking me, you see Cal's a homeless outreach worker, and I was taking him around, and I said in one of the scenes, Cal needs to get a gun. And he's on the street, he's in a bad neighborhood, where can I get a gun? And I figured, show me a pawn shop or show me a thing. And instead, he said, go to McDonald's or Burger King in a bad neighborhood, in any bad neighborhood in the country, and you go into the bathroom, and you stand on that toilet, and you see that white tile, you push it upward, and you feel around, you'll find a gun. Not in everyone. You'll have to find it every once in a while, but kids can't take them to schools. They got metal detectors there. They don't want to bring them home because aunt, uncle, mom, dad, someone's going to take it. So they hide them in fast food restaurants, and that is just a cool detail that I was like, I don't care what it takes. I'm putting that in the book. And so that's just one of the fun ones. And obviously just getting to look at the Cain and Abel stuff also is, I don't know why it's an obsession of mine, but it just was. It was one of the stories I always liked. And just finding those details. When I got the one about the vampires, I loved. When someone said that, that's where, one of the theories of where it comes from, again, that's one of those days when I go home and say, oh, Meltzer, you've done it again. I mean, I don't, but, I just go home and say, you're as pathetic as ever. But I love this stuff, and I just love the details. It's never like one day where it's, where you go eureka. It's just the little ones. Yeah, the question is, do I know about Wonder Woman Day? Of course. Not just because my wife dresses like that for my birthday. Everyone's wondering if I'm joking or not. I'm laughing, but it's true. And the question is, why don't you start a Superman Day? They try over and over to try it, to start it. And they always try to, put up memorials, and they always make promises. And the family that lives in the house where Superman was created, when I went there, she said to me, do you know, she was pissed off because she started, you start asking her the stories and she starts telling them. They swell up in her and she's yelling at me and says, Brad, that Cleveland won't even give me a plaque. They won't even give us a plaque to say that Superman was created in this house. And I just thought, that's disgusting to me. So I said to her that day, I'm going to get you your plaque and I'm coming back. And we gave her her plaque. I had Alex Ross, who's one of the greatest artists in comics, drew a picture of Superman just for him. We had it etched in granite because he's the Man of Steel. I don't even know if granite's steel, but it's rock. We told him, we're like, here's the Man of Steel. It's a mineral. That's it. and put it on a mahogany thing, and we gave him that. And she said to me, you know, every couple of years someone comes to my house and says they're going to save it, and every couple of years they come to my house and say they want to have a parade, and every couple of years they come to my house and say they want to build a statue on the front lawn, and every couple of years I get excited, and every couple of years I'm totally brokenhearted, and I realize that people can't make it happen. And I didn't make it happen. I just happened to call other people who called other people who called other people. And again, regular people are going to save this house. And if we may fail miserably, but we're going to try. And the best part was that she read the book and she said, love the book, but you made me 80 years old. And so I owe her for that. Yeah, the question is do we ever hit up Seinfeld? One of the guys who helped, in fact, got the most auction pieces along with me, who split the auction work with me, is a guy named Dave Mandel, who used to write for Seinfeld. He wrote the Bizarro episode, right? Comic Geeks, we stick together. And obviously, we're working it. Trust me, we're working it. But the best research from Superman is not Jerry Seinfeld. It's going back into I got to speak to Stan Lee, you know, created X-Men and the Fantastic Four. Spider-Man, along, you know, with the artists who did go, and these are amazing people to me. And to get to speak to Jerry Robinson. I mean, Jerry Robinson, and I read about this, but I asked him the story because I wanted to know if it was true. Jerry Robinson created the Joker. I mean, that's the reason we get Heath Ledger in the movie. And he told me this story that was incredible. You know, Joe Shuster and Jerry Siegel, at the ends of their careers, really, they had nothing at this point. Joe Shuster was going blind. He's the artist. He's going blind. He created Superman and has no money. Jerry Siegel is delivering mail at a California utility company, and the movie's about to come out, and these guys have nothing. Their name's not on it, nothing. And they're trying to get a pension going, and Jerry Robinson, who created the Joker, just said, this is wrong. Neil Adams said, this is wrong, and you know, said, you guys got to do right by these people. They created your character, and fought for them. And Jerry Siegel finally said to him, I can't fight anymore. I don't have any money for a lawyer. It's Time Warner. You know, they're a big company. I can't fight this battle anymore. And he said, I'm going to take whatever they offer tonight. And Jerry Robinson said, just give me one day, one night tonight. And he called up the lawyer, and the lawyer said to him, you know, I can't put, you know, Jerry Robinson said, you got to put their names on stuff. People need to know who they are. And he said, I can't put their name on every toy. He says, okay, fine. Don't worry about the toys. We're not going to put it on the leg of the action figure. But he said, you got to put their names in the movie. You know, you have the movie coming out. You got to put their names in it. And the lawyer said to him, you know, I would love to, I really would, but the credits are already done for the movie. There's nothing we can do. And Jerry Robinson looks at him and goes, I've been working in movies many years, and I know credits are the last effing thing you work on. And there's this long pause, and the guy says, let me call you back. And, you know, it's Jerry Robinson that I get to speak to and hear that story. And that's the only reason you get to see Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster have that credit today that appears in every single Superman comic, because that guy was a hero. I mean, he stood up for his friend and said, don't do it. So thanks for joining us and skipping the opening of the Redskins game. And that also means a lot. Have a good night.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.